Our Bible reading this morning is taken from the Gospel of Matthew, and we're going to read at chapter 8. Matthew chapter 8. We're going to take up our reading this morning at verse 18. Matthew chapter 8 at verse 18. When Jesus saw the crowd around him, he gave orders to cross to the other side of the lake. Then a teacher of the law came and said, "Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go." Jesus replied, "Foxes have dens and birds have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." Another disciple came to him, "Lord, first let me go and bury my father." But Jesus told him, "Follow me, and let the dead bury their own dead." Then he got into the boat, and his disciples followed him. Suddenly, a furious squall came up on the lake, so that the waves swept over the boat. But Jesus was sleeping. The disciples went and woke him, saying, "Lord, save us. We're going to drown." He replied, "You of little faith, why are you so afraid?" Then he got up and rebuked the wind and the waves, and it was completely calm. The men were amazed and asked, "What kind of man is this? Even the winds and the waves obey him." When he arrived at the other side in the region of the Gadarenes, two demon-possessed men came coming from the tombs met him. They were so violent that no one could pass that way. "What do you want with us, Son of God?" they shouted. "Have you come here to torture us before the appointed time?" Some distance from them, a large herd of pigs was feeding. The demons begged Jesus, "If you drive us out, send us into the herd of pigs." He said to them, "Go." So they came out and went into the pigs, and the whole herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and died in the water. Those tending the pigs ran off, went into the town and reported all this, including what had happened to the demon-possessed men. Then the whole town went out to meet Jesus, and when they saw him, they pleaded with him to leave their region. Matthew chapter 8, if you have your Bibles open, we will be referring to the teaching of that passage from verse 18 to the end. In the last 10 days or so, we've seen on our news bulletins that the largest ever Royal Navy ship that was fabricated in the UK, HMS Queen Elizabeth, was floated free in Rosyth, under the bridges in the Firth, and is away now on 2 years of sea trials. Last week she was spotted in the Moray Firth, and I believe she's in the Cromarty Firth as we speak just now. Now, the construction of that warship has been quite an operation. Various different segments of the ship were fabricated in different locations around the British Isles, and then they were floated, these massive, huge sections, floated around to Rosyth, where, like a large, epic Lego set, the whole of the ship was put together so that what we now see on our screens, or perhaps you've seen in the Firth, or perhaps may see in coming days, so that what we now see is the completed picture. Section by section has joined together, and so now it's obvious what you're looking at. In our examination of the Gospel of Matthew, we are doing something similar. We're going through the Gospel of Matthew section by section, and each section is joining with the next section and the next section to build before our eyes an understanding of the life and of the mission and of the identity and the impact and the death and the resurrection and the ascension of the Lord Jesus Christ. And section by section by section, joining together, creates for us this impression of who Jesus actually is. And it generates in turn, therefore, a question for me and for you as to how do we respond to the identity of Jesus Christ. Let me just explain what we've been doing. We've looked at the Sermon on the Mount, chapters 5 to 7 of this Gospel. And at the end of chapter 7, we have the note given to us there that he taught as one who had authority and not as someone, as a teacher of the law. When Jesus spoke, there was a power, there was a weightiness, there was an authority to what he said that marked him out as being very different. But we know that sometimes talk is cheap, don't we? And so we're left asking, is there any substance behind this style? And chapter 8 to 10, the next section of this Gospel, gives to us the teaching that not simply does Jesus have authority in what he says, but he has authority in what he does. And so the previous section spoke of dealing with an unclean leper and a Gentile soldier and lots of other people who were ill. And all it took was for Jesus to say the word, and these individuals were cleansed. And unlike anybody else in Jesus' day, when Jesus touched those who were unclean, it's not that contamination from their uncleanness came to Jesus. It was the complete opposite. Purity and cleansing came from Jesus into their lives. And so you have the authority of his teaching. You have the authority of his actions. And it's now prompting us to have one of these questions come to mind and say, who actually is this? Because it's not enough for us simply to recognize that Jesus has authority to speak and authority to do things that nobody else could. It must bring us to a conclusion as to who he is. It's a bit like, you know, you're running a race and you're leading the pack. And then you're leading the pack, but all of a sudden you decide to stop before you get to the finishing line. That's how foolish it would be to take on board the authority of Jesus' words, the authority of Jesus' actions, but not see where that is pointing, because it's pointing to who Jesus is. And this next section of Matthew chapter 8 clarifies for us who Jesus is. And that's why we're going to study it for a few moments this morning. The first thing that we're going to see, and this is given to us in the section from verse 18 to verse 22, is that Jesus is the individual that we obey. He is the one that we obey. I know from our own experience that school report cards were issued a number of weeks ago, and sometimes you'll see on social media the decoding pictures for school report cards. You know, it's very different to the way it was in previous generations where, you know, you're trying not to be particularly negative about certain things. And so there's certain phrases that come up in report cards, don't they? And so the phrase contributes well to class discussion is a code. Some of you are nodding, you understand it. It's a code for somebody who doesn't shut up. And, you know, another one that I came across recently was that enjoys guiding and instructing friends in tasks, which says the pupil's really, really bossy. And sometimes we need to decode the terms that are used to understand what's been spoken of. And I say that from the point of view is that the first individual who came to meet Jesus in this passage in verse 18 and 19, he comes and he sees he's a teacher of the law, so he's a kind of professional religious guy, and he comes and he says, "Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go." And you say, well, okay, that's fine. Teacher. I want you to notice, though, it's very different to the address that the previous people in this chapter have used. They have used the address to Jesus. The man with leprosy says, "Lord, if you're willing, you can cleanse me." And the Gentile soldier, he says, "Lord, my servant lies at home paralyzed and he's suffering terribly." And they're looking at Jesus as somebody who has this unique authority. They're looking at Jesus as somebody who alone has this power to deal with this huge, immediate, pressing need that they have. This man comes and he says, "Teacher." And he speaks about what he will do. In distinction to what's happened previously in this passage, where these individuals come and speak of what Jesus will do for them. And so the very way in which this man comes and speaks to Jesus tells us that he views Jesus very differently to the other individuals that we've encountered in this passage up until this point. That he views Jesus not as the answer, not as the power, but he views him as a teacher, as somebody that's worth listening to, as somebody that he wants and has this desire to listen to a little bit more. But he's way short of acknowledging him as Lord. And so Jesus, in his answer, speaks to him to try and enable him to come to an understanding of who he is and what he's actually about. And in verse 20, you've got the answer of Jesus, "Foxes have dens and birds have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." And so for the first time in this gospel, we are introduced to this favorite designation that Jesus gives, his favorite way of describing himself, the Son of Man. And we may initially look at a phrase like this and think he's highlighting the kind of human side. We know the Bible tells us that Jesus took a human nature to his divine nature. So maybe this Son of Man title speaks about his human side. Actually, it doesn't. It's the opposite. And the reason we know that is that earlier on in the Bible, in the Old Testament, passages like Daniel chapter 7 speaks of this Son of Man figure. This individual who comes into the heavenly court and is coming in and is given this power and authority, this position of exaltation that would last forever. That is what the Son of Man spoke of. Here, Jesus takes this phrase and he uses it himself. And he says that he is, if you like, this Son of Man figure. He is not simply a teacher, but he is Lord. He has authority, he has and will be exalted. He is unlike anybody else. He is the Son of Man. And yet, on this mission, the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. You may have seen the recent BBC series that's actually ongoing, entitled The Wick the Landlords Moved In. And it talks about how, you know, a huge proportion of the UK population now doesn't own their own home, they rent a home, and there's this burgeoning kind of group of landlords. And the whole premise behind the program is that the landlord who owns and is in charge of the of these flats or whatever, they move in and they sample life, the life that the people who are paying them rent actually have. And it's quite revealing, and there's a pattern emerging. And so the landlord moves in, and the landlord is shocked. He didn't realize the place was in such a mess. And he's appalled when he sees the mold. And he turns the taps on. Man, they don't even have hot water. And the wiring's all looking a bit frazzled, and he's going, well, I had no idea it was like this. And in one of the episodes that I saw, he said, I don't want anyone to live like this. Take that analogy of the Son of Man, the exalted, authoritative, unique power that is Jesus Christ, the Son of God, coming in as creator into the world that he has created, and to be rejected, to be ignored, to be despised, and the world that he called into existence, he has nothing even to call home within that world. And so here you have Jesus combining not simply this servant-hearted willingness to fulfill this mission that he has been given, a mission that's going to see him coming lower and lower and lower into this world, into this kind of brokenness of the world, but he does so as one who has kingly authority. He is the Son of Man. And when he uses that phrase in other parts of the Gospels, he's going to use it in the context of having the power to forgive sins, and he's unique, and yet he is going to come and he is going to be in a place that he doesn't even have a home. Such is his mission. And so he answers this man from the point of view of drawing this man's attention to the cost of following Jesus. He's coming out with this grand statement, I'll follow you wherever you go. Just a wee bit like Peter, one of Jesus' disciples, later on in the gospel. Listen, all these other disciples may abandon you. I will never, ever, ever do that. It's just words. Jesus is drawing this man's attention to the fact there is a cost to following Jesus. And if the Lord of creation, if the Lord of heaven is in a world that rejects and is in a world that even though he has made is not home, should we, as the followers of Jesus, therefore expect an easy life with little troubles, always given a welcome at the top table of our nation, and all these kind of various different privileges that may be ours? Can we expect that? And the obvious answer is no, we can't. If Jesus was despised, he tells us we're going to be despised. So there's a cost in following Jesus. And that's built on in the next couple of verses when this other disciple comes and says, Lord, first let me go and bury my father. And you're left that thinking, well, that's rather a shocking statement, because Jesus comes and says, effectively, no, follow me. And let the dead bury their own dead. And you're going, well, that's not what I thought Jesus was like. Is Jesus not compassionate? Is Jesus not caring? Has he just had a bad day? You know, we all have bad days. Is that what happened here? Jesus lost his compassion at this moment? And we're going, no, because there's more to it than just what meets the eye here in verse 21. We bear in mind that this man's father had not died. Because had he died in that culture, he would be preparing for and attending the funeral that would take place that selfsame day. In fact, there's no indication that this man, that his father, was actually near the end. He might have been in the last phase of his life, but there's no indication that his demise was imminent. Because what this guy is effectively asking Jesus is, can I get this part of my life out of the way? And then once I've had this part of my life done, then I will come and I'll engage with you. I'll acknowledge who you are. I will follow you. I'll obey you. I'll do the whole church thing. But let me get this part of my life, let me get that sorted first. Because that is effectively what this guy is saying. And what he says is something that many in here experienced and actually are experiencing just now and saying, listen, I know there's something true here. I know I need to deal with this message, but I can't do it just now. Jesus, can you not just let me get this part of my life over and done with? Let me get school out of the way. Let me get university out of the way. Let me get life with the kids out of the way. Let me just get my working life out of the way, because if I become a Christian, life in the yard and the office, it's going to be a nightmare. Just let me get that out of the way, and then I will respond to you. And Jesus is saying, we're to follow him. He is the one we're meant to obey. Now, David and Emma know what it's like as parents when they call the boys for tea. And unless their children are unlike any other children, so I doubt it, the boys will hear. And if they're watching TV, they'll hear. And then they'll watch TV for another few seconds. Or they'll go and have another play for another few seconds until they hear David or Emma or any other kind of parent or guardian, dinner now. And they go, oh, it's a different tone of voice. And they come because they recognize the authority and they recognize it's time to obey. And they recognize actually to delay at this point would not be a wise idea. And yet, David and Emma are not sovereign. No parent is sovereign. We're not divine. We're not all powerful. But there is one in the gospel who is sovereign, divine, all powerful. And he says, today, follow me. Not tomorrow, not when this phase of your life is over and done with, but he says, today, he is the one that we need to obey. And that leads us on to the next part of this passage, which tells us that he is the one that we can trust. Because you may just hear the message and think, well, okay, I need to obey him, but can I trust him? We know on a human level that where humans often get into a position of authority and power, that over time they begin to abuse that position of authority and power. They try to retain it when it shouldn't be retained. And we just know what it's like. We've lived in this world long enough. Humans, if they have authority and power over time, will abuse it. Is that what's going to happen with this guy, Jesus? Can we actually trust him going forward? Well, Jesus is not like some kind of human leader, some kind of human authority. Jesus is unique. He is in a category all of his own. He is the only Son of Man. And as such, we can trust him. And the next two incidents tell us as to why that's the case. First of all, in verse 23 to verse 27, you have the account of the disciples doing what Jesus said. In verse 18, Jesus saw the crowd and he gave orders to cross the other side of the lake. If you want to see a wee hint that Jesus is unlike other rulers, there you have a hint. Other people want to have crowds, want to have adulation, want to have a great amount of followers. Jesus sees the crowds and he retreats. And he's telling them they're going to cross over. Verse 23, then he got into a boat and the disciples followed him. So they're obeying him. They are doing what he wanted. And as they do what they want, they're out onto this boat, and out of nowhere, this storm breaks. Now, many of you may have seen some of these YouTube clips of the ferry journey from Aberdeen to Shetland on a rough day. And you see some of these kind of clips of what it's like in the cafeteria section when it starts getting rough. And so there's a bit of movement for a while, you know, and that's a bit kind of bearable, and then all of a sudden, phew, everything comes flying off the tables. And then it goes the other way, and on the floor you've got the cups, and you've got things going one way or to the other, and you think, 20 hours of this until we reach Shetland, rather them than me. And so when we think of storms, that's what kind of springs to mind, things like that. However, the term that's used here, about this storm that came up, was actually quite an unusual term. It was a kind of seismic storm that broke here. It was a storm here that speaks of something deadly, perhaps even something slightly sinister. And so they're in the middle of this storm, and these disciples, they are gripped by fear. Jesus is gripped by exhaustion. Having exerted himself, having been caring for individuals through his teaching and physical ministry, he's now exhausted. He's asleep. So they're gripped by fear, he's gripped by exhaustion, and then next, he's gripped by their fear. And literally it tells us that the disciples went and they woke him. So you're not just saying, Jesus, can you wake up? This is a storm raging. If you've ever been in a fierce weather storm that really unsettles you, you know that you can't just whisper. You need to get someone's attention. So you can imagine them kind of gripping Jesus, almost waking him up and saying, Lord, save us. We were gone for. And so here is a group of people that have followed Jesus. They have obeyed Jesus. And they come to Jesus in their difficulty, and Jesus questions their lack of faith. He speaks to the wind and the waves, and it went completely calm. And so they're left asking this question, who is he? Who is he? He's commanded us to do something and we've obeyed. But yet, have we fully grasped who he is? That even the waves are subject to him? I mean, you and I can't control the waves in a bath, let alone the waves in a sea. But when Jesus spoke, not simply did the wind die down, but the waves went calm. And those of you who are seamen know that even when the wind goes, the waves carry on, because there's a swell that's kind of sometimes been built up there, and it takes a while for the waves then to stop. But no, instantly, from that noise, from that fear, to calm. And they were almost more afraid of the calm than they were of the storm. Why? Because they're realizing that this is somebody unique. The identity of Jesus is impressed upon them. And where it tells us in the Old Testament that there is only a single individual who can control the seas, and that is God. Here is Jesus exhibiting the power of God over the elements. Who is he? Well, look at the sections. His authority to teach, his authority to heal, his authority over the elements. Who is he? This is the Son of Man. This is the exalted, authoritative Lord of heaven. This is the one that we've got to obey. And the next and final episode in this passage tells us about Jesus encountering two individuals who had been demon-possessed. You know, in the modern mind, when they hear about demons and they roll their eyes, oh, really? Really? Such a thing as demons? Yes, there is. There's a spiritual world. There's a spirit world. And the more our country actually abandons the Christian ethos that has established our country and was the foundation of our country for hundreds of years, the more that vacuum will not remain a vacuum, that there will be more of that spirit world dynamic that will fill it. And so the demons here, ironically, when the disciples are asking who is this, the demons know exactly who it is. And the demons know three things. They know the identity. What do you want with us, Son of God? You're not a teacher. You're not a great healer. You are the Son of God. What do you want with us? So they knew who Jesus was. They knew they were powerless before Jesus. Have you come to deal with us now? We can't do anything against this. And they also knew what their fate was, their final fate at the hands of Jesus, because he would have that authoritative final judgment upon them. So they're not left kind of questioning, well, you know, who is Jesus? Is he just one teacher of a whole host of other kind of good teachers that history has thrown up? No, they know that he is in a category all by himself, that he is the Son of God. And so when you see the control that he has over chaos, when you see how he banishes the demonic, we are seeing here that Jesus is ticking the boxes of what was going to happen when the promise made at the very beginning of the world, when God promised that one would come who would deal with Satan's power, who would crush the serpent's head, that one person would come who would be able to do that. We are seeing this lived out. That chaos is nothing before Jesus. That demonic power is nothing before Jesus, because he has come to dismantle and to destroy the domain of God's enemy, your enemy, my enemy, Satan. This is God. And so therefore, in conclusion, you would think, well, had we been there, had we witnessed these two individuals being set free from this demon possession, had we witnessed the storm being changed into a calm at his command and will, then it'd be obvious, wouldn't it? We would follow. We'd do what he said. He's the one we obey. He's the one we would trust. We'd respond, wouldn't we? It's obvious. And yet this chapter is bookended by two sets of individuals who engage with Jesus but don't apparently follow. So you've got the teacher who's told about the cost of following. We've got no indication that he actually followed Jesus. And at the end of the passage, the town that Jesus had performed this miracle in, they came out and they asked him to leave their region. You see, for the teacher at the start, the cost was too much. You know, there was a kind of comfort cost that, you know, he didn't really want his life to be that kind of upset and unsettled by following Jesus. For the people in this kind of area of the Gadarenes, there was a financial cost. I mean, oh, look how much money's been gone, just in one foul swoop. All these pigs, all the stock that was invested, all gone. Get out of here. We don't want you here. Don't you see? He's healed people. He's got the power to do this. No. Finance is more important. So with the teacher, it was the life he had. He wasn't going to let that up. With the people here, it was the finance. That was the big cost for them. And the reality is, for you today, if you've not yet trusted in Jesus, there is a cost. There is a reason that you're not doing so. And it might just be what people are going to say. It might be your reputation. It might be your life is going to have to change, but you know there is going to be a cost. Are you really going to let that cost be more significant than the call of the Son of Man for you to follow him, and in following him, to know his protection, to know his provision of life lived to the full now and a life lived with God forever? Is the cost really greater than what Jesus gives to us in the gospel? And if you think that perhaps it is, let me finish with this final analogy. The cost that you have in your mind, put it to one side and contrast it with the cost that Jesus paid to enable a way of salvation for men and women, boys and girls. What was the cost that Jesus paid? Well, that was the cost of leaving glory to come into this broken world, for moving into this world that was full of mold, that was full of no hot water and dodgy electrics, and an awful lot worse than that. To go and to live fulfilling this mission that would ultimately see him on the cross paying the penalty for something he didn't do. He'd never sinned against God. I had. You have. And yet he's there taking that penalty, paying that price, taking that cost, so that you might know what it is to be free of guilt. You might know what it is to be forgiven. You might know what it is to be accepted. And so don't let whatever the cost that is on your mind today about following Jesus obscure the authoritative command that he gives to follow him. Put the pieces of the construction together. Who is he? He is the master who calls us today to follow. Amen.